Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking about a film made by and with child soldiers, and we're going to be speaking with dancer, choreographer, and environmentalist Jennifer Monson. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jonathan and Tad Richards. They are co-authors of the new novel, Nick and Jake, and there will be a reading from the book with the authors, as well as Alan Arkin, Ali McGraw, and Allison Roper, at 6 o'clock this Saturday, the 30th of October, at Collected Works Bookstore. It's a free event. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here, Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
Very nice.
So this is an epistolary novel. That means the whole thing is made up of letters that people write to each other, set in 1953. First of all, the title is Nick and Jake. Who are Nick and Jake?
Nick and Jake are the narrators and central characters of two of the great first-person novels of 20th century American literature, Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby and Jake Barnes from The Sun Also Rises.
And during the course of the novel, almost all the characters are borrowed, either from 20th century fiction or 20th century history. We have a few that we invented ourselves, but mostly we're recycling.
It's such an interesting thing to be taking real people and fictional characters and just mixing them all up.
I've always loved to do that. In a lot of my writing, I've done that.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, these two gentlemen may sound rather similar because, in fact, Jonathan and Tad Richards are brothers.
We are brothers and can be mistaken for each other.
Indeed.
He can do an accent all the way through. That would help.
I could do my Jimmy Stewart impression all the way through.
Of course, my Jimmy Stewart impression is considerably better.
No, just don't. Just stop right now. But have you been working together? Have you been collaborating together before in your life?
We've written a few novels together. We wrote a trilogy of novels set in the American labor movement from about the time of the Civil War through the Palmer raids in the 20s. And I guess that's pretty much the main collaboration.
Yeah, that's the main. And Cherokee Bill. We did a novel about the Old West. And then for a number of years, we didn't collaborate, and then we just started again. We've written a few one-act plays together, and then Nick and Jake.
And Nick and Jake came out of an idea that Tad tossed out over lunch one day, probably a good 10 years ago, in which he said, what do you think it would be like if Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby and Jake Barnes from The Sun Also Rises were to meet maybe 25 years after their day in the sun, if they were to meet in Paris, what would they talk about? What would it be like? And that's where this idea came from.
And we discussed it actually for many years. We kicked it around and we actually didn't know if we could do it. And then maybe 8 or 9 years ago, a novel came out called The Wind Done Gone, which was Gone with the Wind retold from the point of view of the slaves. The Margaret Mitchell estate sued to prevent it from being published, and they lost. And there was an important court ruling that said you can use iconic fictional characters for satiric purposes. So we figured, hey, we're home free.
For satiric purposes specifically?
That was the ruling, because just last year, a novel came out that purported to be about Holden Caulfield, age 90. And it was really presented as like a sequel. And the Salinger estate sued and won because
it wasn't funny enough.
Yeah, because it was presented as a sequel to the original, which you really can't do. But
right.
This you can do.
You can do that if you're licensed to do it, which has been done.
Right. Now, these characters, of course, have aged since. I mean, they were what, in their 20s in these novels that came out in the 20s, and
right.
Now they're in their 50s in the 1950s.
And they've aged in very different ways. Nick, who in our version actually did write this novel about his friend Gatsby and his experiences as a young man, but then he got out of writing. He went back to the Midwest. He kind of settled into a middle-class life. He married. He started his own advertising agency. He's a good Midwestern Republican, and as the novel starts, His ad agency has done some work for the Eisenhower campaign, and he's been rewarded with a small position in the State Department. So he's an undersecretary of state.
And Jake Barnes has stayed in Paris, where we last saw him, and has become the managing editor of the Paris Herald Tribune, and is kind of an expatriate, sort of a grisly old curmudgeon who comments on world affairs from an American in Paris's point of view.
Now, were you trying, or do you think in some way you had Jake Barnes writing kind of like Hemingway?
We definitely had that as a conscious influence. We tried to use Fitzgerald cadences for at least the early Nick Carraway letters, and the same thing with Hemingway's cadences for Jake Barnes's letters.
But pretty quickly, one finds that they were our characters. What would Jake Barnes be like 30 years later? What would Nick Carraway be like 30 years later? Then you get into the characters, they take on a life of their own, and they become new characters. They become our characters.
And one of the great catalysts that sets this story in motion is the McCarthy hearings, the Red Scare of the early and middle 50s. And so they interact not only with each other, they interact with other fictional characters like Larry Darrell from The Razor's Edge and like Alden Pyle from The Quiet American. And they interact with Joe McCarthy and with Roy Cohn and with
right.
And then Robert Cohn, who is the writer who is Jake's friend in The Sun Also Rises, in our version becomes a rogue CIA agent who is Roy Cohn's uncle.
Right.
So we really bring together real and fictional characters, even with relations with each other, as relatives to each other.
And there's tremendous scope for your literary imaginations in this, and there's also the kind of fantasy fulfillment that probably everybody who's ever read any work of fiction has had, which is when you close the book, well, what happens after that?
Right.
Exactly, yes. And we don't have these characters. They both have written books which are recognizable as The Great Gatsby and The Sun Also Rises, but not called those.
Right.
And actually, no, we actually decided that Jake had never written The Sun Also Rises because there's something about the book, The Sun Also Rises, that you get the feeling that this is a story that Jake tells one night to a bartender. So in our version, he tells it one night to a bartender and he never writes it. What he writes instead is a history of Paris.
It's more like a movable feast.
Right.
Yes.
And the title of the book that our Nick Carraway has written is Trimalchio in West Egg, which was one of the titles that Fitzgerald had considered for what eventually became The Great Gatsby. It was his first working title.
How do you know that?
How do we know that, Tad?
It's actually fairly well known. The great editor, Maxwell Perkins, who was both Hemingway's and Fitzgerald's editors. A lot has been written about him, and he was the one who titled the book The Great Gatsby, where Fitzgerald had wanted to call it Trimalchio at West Egg.
And Trimalchio is a character, from the...
Satyricon, the original Satyricon.
The Satyricon.
Petronius
the
is Satyricon.
Right.
But, you know, knowing things is kind of what we do, you know, in a lot of our work, both together and separately, is putting together popular culture, history, our own invention. It's what we do.
Well, I mean, and it's what fiction writers do, and it's why they're so literally awesome. I mean, I am in awe of people who can especially become other characters and know them from the inside on some level. It's sort of, to me, it's a weirdly similar to acting.
Except one of the main differences is in acting you're working with lines that are already there, whereas in writing fiction you suddenly discover, and any writer of fiction will tell you this, that a character who you thought was going to do something ends up doing something entirely different.
Right.
Right. We two of our important characters in the novel are Roy Cohn, well known from Angels in America and so forth, who was McCarthy's chief aide, and Roy Cohn's young friend, perhaps lover, David Schein, who is the guy who basically, it was his story that brought down McCarthy. Cohn and McCarthy tried to keep Schein out of the military. That's why they took on the Army McCarthy hearings at Old Windows. But so, you know, we started out with these two characters as both villains, and we ended up realizing Davy Schein, in our version, isn't a villain at all. He's a very likable character.
Sweet guy.
Who becomes, who, you know, comes through as a mensch.
Roy's kind of a villain.
Roy, I would think it's pretty hard to write any kind of book or history in which Roy Cohn is not a villain.
Yes.
It was very difficult. I did actually interview Roy Cohn once.
Did you really?
I did, yes.
Why? What was that like? What?
It was for a celebrity-type magazine, and he was very anxious that we not just talk about the McCarthy hearings, which is all I knew about him. So I said, well, what else do you want to talk about? And he then told me about how many friends he had. He spent a whole paragraph just telling me about what a lot of good friends he had, and his friends and he would get together, and they would fly down to New Orleans for the Super Bowl. And I remember sitting there thinking, this is a man without a friend in the world.
Yeah.
Then he took me down. He showed me his townhouse where he had his office on the penthouse floor, and he took me down to show me his bedroom. I was much younger at the time, and I guess I had a certain, you know, glow. So he showed me his bedroom, and what I remember, the two most salient features of his bedroom, aside from the mirrored canopy over the bed, was the nose cone of an ICBM, which I felt was a, you know, he was trying to make a statement. You know.
The nose cone of a missile?
Yes.
In his bedroom.
And the other thing was he was very proud of having the world's largest collection of animal bands, little ceramic squirrels and badgers playing violins and drums and things like that all around, yeah, the entire.
So he'd been to Jackalope.
I guess he probably had, yeah.
We're talking to Jonathan and Tad Richards about their new novel, Nick and Jake. So back to the McCarthy hearings for a moment, which play an important role in your book. There is a character in the book whose name is Ronnie Gilchrist, Veronica Gilchrist, and she is called in front of the hearings because they think that she's Ronnie Gilbert rather than Ronnie Gilchrist, and she's a sweet, nice lady who has a children's TV show, and they're accusing her of being a communist and ruin her career. How realistic is that?
This is actually based on something that really happened back in those days. It wasn't the McCarthy Committee, but it was a magazine called Red Channels, a newsletter which was dedicated to exposing subversives in the entertainment industry. And the entertainment industry blacklist came from Red Channels. And there was a young woman who had a TV show in the Midwest where she sang nursery rhymes to little kids, and Red Channels got her mixed up with somebody else who had a similar name.
But not even the same name.
Not even the same name. It was like, I think her name was like Vivian Reed or something, and they mixed her up with somebody named Susan Reed. As here we have Ronnie Gilbert and Ronnie Gilchrist. And her career was destroyed. Yeah, she was blacklisted. She lost her TV show.
Once you get on those lists, it's not very easy to get off of them.
Right. One of the things that was striking about it, and probably most people have heard moments from the McCarthy hearings, it is part of our popular culture and literature, that but reading the transcript of it, which is presumably realistic to the real event, one begins to realize that the kind of false accusations and helpless defensiveness is something whose residue is still with us today.
Well, Bill O'Reilly is very much like Joe McCarthy in his attitude. The bullying, the hectoring, the bullying kind of thing, and absolute conviction, of course, that he's right. You know, it's fine to be convinced that you're right, but there's a certain style that I think somebody with power uses over somebody with less power, and that's what we're trying to show in that scene.
And it has absolutely nothing to do with truth-seeking.
No. No, I mean, as older listeners will remember, McCarthy famously would brandish pieces of paper at press events, saying, I have here in my hand the names of 97 known communists in the State Department. And then 5 minutes later, somebody would say, excuse me, Senator, how many communists was that? 137 communists in the State Department.
And there was never any such list. You know, right. He would just pull laundry lists out of his pocket. But one of the things that really got us going on this book, which we'd talked about for so long, was, horribly enough, 9-1-1. And, you know, we followed with horror the whole thing, as everyone did, but also how, after the period after 9-1-1, there was this such tremendous outpouring of goodwill throughout the world for America, and the Bush administration managed to trash it very quickly.
In the same way that the goodwill that America came out of World War II with as the savior of Western civilization was pretty quickly frittered away by the communist scare and by other things that America did that there's a kind of an arrogance that didn't take full advantage of the opportunities.
And the other thing that happened in this time period, which we go into in the book, is 1953 was the year of the first CIA adventurism, the first CIA overthrow of a democratic government of another country, which was the Mossadegh government in Iran.
Which had about a 98% favorable rating but was overthrown by irate mobs in the streets, which were basically put out
there. So 98% of the Iranian population favored their government.
Yeah, Mossadegh was like the George Washington of Iran.
Right.
And he was the person who could have brought a secular democracy to the Middle East, but we overthrew him and put the Shah.
Right. So that figures in this book as well.
Yes.
We all know how well that worked out.
Right, exactly. Mm. So when you were writing this, you were writing it in tandem with each other? Did you write it through email?
We did a lot of email.
And mostly email and instant message, because we were living on opposite sides of the country.
You live in New York State.
Yes.
So it was an epistolary novel written in epistolary
fashion,
process.
Right. Yes.
And we had no plot to speak of when we started. What we started doing was trying to paint each other into corners and see how the other one would get out of it. And a plot grew from there.
And we began with the idea that one of us would predominantly write Jake and the other would predominantly write Nick, but we got out of that pretty quickly.
Because, oh, really?
Yeah, that went out the window very quickly.
So because I was going to say, one of you must have been Nick and the other Jake.
That was our original plan, but it's not the way it worked out.
Huh.
We were both chameleons. We went back and forth. And our other major character, and again, comes from 1953, because you know the story of Jake Barnes in The Sun Also Rises. Part of it is that he has lost his male equipment in the war. And so he is this kind of sexless figure. And what would it be like for somebody to live like that for 30 years? And who would understand him? And an important story of 1953 was the world's very first sex change successful sex change operation, Christine Jorgensen. I thought, well, you know, Christine Jorgensen and Jake would have a lot in common. So we developed a relationship between the two of them.
Which begins before the sex change operation, when he is still George Jorgensen, a former GI, and continues through. And we had the great good fortune, when we finally got this book ready to sell at a time when it was very hard to sell books to publishers because there was no money left in the marketplace. So after sitting back and saying, gee, that's too bad for a bit. Tad had the idea that we should do a recorded version of it and put it on the internet and, you know, sell it as a podcast kind of format. So then we started thinking, well, it's an epistolary format. Everything is individual segments. It lends itself not so much to a single reader, a narrator, as most books have, but we could actually cast this. And we were very fortunate in having a number of friends who could bring a lot of headline quality to this. And the first person who we approached was Alan Arkin, who is a very generous and human guy who's a good friend. And I said, would you be willing to read Jake for us? And he said, absolutely. We then contacted somebody I had met in London the summer before, Tom Conti, a great English actor. And I originally contacted his wife, who I knew slightly better, to see if she would do Lady Brett Ashley, and she said yes, and she would love to. And I said, by the way, you know, if Tom would like to do something, we'd love to have him. And she emailed back and said, Tom says if the great Arkin is in, I'm in too. So, and then
nice.
We got, and then Allie McGraw, who is also a wonderful person and good friend, I think, of yours as well, said she would do Christine Jorgensen, and she had some interesting observations on the character, which we were able to develop and work in
and
from her input.
Tremendously improved the character. Her suggestions were wonderful.
Very
and then the rest of the cast is made up of both, you know, professionals and you know, some local people and some non-professionals and some, you know, some writers and some
family members.
Yeah.
You know, and it's when you think about this form of novel, it's as much like a play as it is like a novel, in the sense that you can't have an overarching narrative saying, and then he slammed the door, you know.
Right, exactly. There's no narrative connective tissue. It's all in the individual.
It's all in the voice of the speaker, essentially, which lends it very well to being spoken.
Exactly.
I had an interesting experience. I'm a part-time college professor, and a student of mine from a few years ago came to visit me last summer. And I was telling her about this project and figured, you know, young woman in her 20s, I started to explain to her who Christine Jorgensen was. And she said, oh, my God, Christine Jorgensen, my grandfather was George Jorgensen's best friend in high school.
Oh, my
Isn't
goodness.
That amazing?
There's a coincidence for you. The novel is called Nick and Jake. Jonathan and Tad Richards, brothers, are co-authors of this novel. And once again, there will be a reading from it with the authors, with Alan Arkin, Allie McGraw, Allison Roper, 6 o'clock this Saturday, the 30th of October, at Collected Works Bookstore. And, of course, it's a wonderful place to have readings.
Fabulous.
Because of their...
And I just want to mention that both the book and the CD set of the recorded version will be available at that event.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you,
thank
Mary
you.
Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy now to welcome Kurt Shaw. He is executive director of the organization Shine a Light, and he is the director of the film Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which has its U.S. premiere on October 30th, this Saturday at the CCA at 1 in the afternoon. It's the world's first film that was written and filmed, directed, and I guess acted also, entirely by former child soldiers in Colombia.
In Colombia.
So tell us about how this film got to be made in the first place.
In 2003, I had worked in Colombia with an organization called Taller de Vida, which works with refugee kids and has come to work with child soldiers. Made a film which was about the experience of refugee kids in the school system, looking at ways to modify the school system, to do school reform so that it's more appropriate for the 2 million refugee children in Colombia. When Taller de Vida started to work with child soldiers, they invited me back. They'd started a video program. They'd found that video was a really interesting way to work with kids. And everything else emerged from the kids themselves.
And so these kids, what was their role as child soldiers? How did they get into that in the first place? Who were they?
There's an idea that comes out of a lot of child soldier literature from Africa, things that you remember. Ismael Bey's biography was in Starbucks, for instance, a couple years ago. And the idea that all child soldiers are recruited involuntarily, that they're forced in. And in fact, that's not true in Colombia. Most of these kids were between 10 and 12 years old. And so, of course, there's a question for us. They've reached the age of reason and can make such decisions.
Right.
But in most cases, they had one of two reasons to join the armed groups. First of all, they had seen so much suffering in their own families, and they saw that the salary of being a child soldier, which is about $300 a month, would be sufficient to buy more food for their younger brothers. So that was one major motivation. Second motivation was that they had seen their families murdered by the other side. And so they joined in order to get revenge. And, of course, like I said, when you're 12 years old, it's really hard to make those sorts of decisions. Nonetheless, most of them said that it was the first adult decision they'd ever made. Then suddenly, they get into the FARC, the Marxist guerrillas, or the ELN, another Marxist guerrilla, or the paramilitaries, and they don't have any choices whatsoever. They are in something that would make even the United States military look like a nice liberal organization. Just no choices, brutal beatings. Almost all the girls were submitted to rape as an initiation rite. Really horrible, horrible things.
So there were girls who signed up also?
Oh, yeah. Yep. In the FARC is about a third women, or a third female. No, I won't say a third women because many of them are under 18.
And so then they were beaten, they were raped. Then they played the role of soldiers? What did they actually do? What was their role as child soldiers?
Mostly when they started, it would be things like sentry duty, carrying stuff, cooking. Though, in fact, it seems as if being a cook was not a safe position. Most of them described the worst beatings they ever got as when they were cooks. If they burned the food, that was a guarantee of being almost threatened to death. And then as they grew older, they might have entered at 12. By the time they were 13 or 14 or 15, they would be radio operators. They would be coming to carry weapons. And at 16, they were full-fledged soldiers.
And how did they, the ones who made this film, how did they get out of that life? Was there pressure for them to stay in once they were on the inside?
It's not just pressure. It's especially the FARC, if they catch you trying to leave, they'll kill you.
Yeah.
A lot of the stories that we heard were of kids being disenchanted. They would get there, and not only did they not get what they wanted, they didn't get the revenge on the other side. They were brutalized. But their family didn't even get paid. Nonetheless, they can't leave. If they
right.
left, they would be
so much for the $300 a month.
Exactly, and so almost all of them who had been on the two guerrilla groups had to flee. And the stories that we heard of that were just extraordinary. Kids walking two weeks through the jungle, always having to be in uniform to carry their weapons, because when they turned themselves into the police, they had to have their uniform and their weapon in order to confirm that they were they were that. And one kid who tried to flee one time, was caught, was sentenced to death, escaped a second time by throwing a grenade into the outhouses when the poop flew. Everyone else was so confused that he ran and ended up floating down a river for 2 weeks in order to get to some place where
good
he...
Heavens.
Extraordinary, extraordinary. And what was amazing is that the first day we started to work on the film, we wanted... The films that we'd worked on in the past were based on the individual stories of kids that we'd worked with in the favelas of Brazil, street kids in Argentina. And so we wanted to do the same thing. Well, let's think about your stories, the stories of what you've gone through, and how can we transform that into a film? They wanted nothing to do with that. And finally, at the end of 8 hours of really hard workshop time, one of the young men who eventually became the protagonist in the film said, "Do you have any idea how hard I tried to get out of the war? And every person who I meet tries to drag me back in. The military intelligence officers who want to know everything that my armed group was doing. The psychologist who says that I've got to talk through it.
Yeah.
The social worker who does this. The file that has to be there. I'm trying to get out of this. Can I tell another story, please?" And so at that point, we did a sort of lesson in literary criticism, not talking about Derrida and Kristeva or anything like that. But what we did is we looked at the way that stories work. The stories that they had were stories of disenchantment. Stories of somebody who desperately wants something, and once they get it, they discover it's not what they wanted at all. And that can be the story of a child soldier, but it can also be the story of a teenage girl who finds that the boyfriend she doesn't like, or of a college graduate who goes to Wall Street and discovers that it's really a bad place. I mean, all of our lives are filled with that. And so we talked about the Spanish Baroque, where desengaño is it's the same idea. Whether it's lots of other stories. And that became the structure of the story itself.
And so instead of making, because when I first became aware that this film was happening, I thought it was going to be a documentary about child soldiers. And in fact, it's a story that they wrote. It's a fiction. It's a narrative movie.
Exactly. And that's really important, because what they insisted on and what we discovered is that the fiction is much more truthful than a documentary. A documentary would focus on how much they had suffered. For them, that wasn't the truth of their lives, not anymore. For them, what was much more important is their capacity to do stuff. Their capacity as thinkers, their capacity to survive in a place that would kill you or me. And they were able to portray that in fiction in a way that they wouldn't be able to portray in a documentary. You have a documentary, you can imagine what a documentary about child soldiers would be like. Oh, these poor kids, they've been this, they've been that.
And it wouldn't be them as subject. It would be them as the object of the film. Some
exactly.
filmmaker is narrating it who's never been inside of that life.
And who's interviewing them and who's asking his questions or her questions. Whereas in this case, the questions that come out of it are the questions that matter to the kids.
Very, very interesting. And so you were there during the whole process.
Right.
From the beginning where that one kid says, look, we want to get out of it. And then the light bulb went on and said, okay, let's make this a fiction. Where did it go from there?
At that point, we began to do lots of theater games. Everything from... one of the ones that I found most entertaining was one kid would say an animal that someone was supposed to imitate, and then the second would be, well, what is that animal doing? So we have a cockroach running to hide from the sun. We have a snake playing football. We have a gorilla lifting weights. And so, to a certain degree, it's great just for being comfortable in front of the camera.
And it sounds like fun.
And it's really fun. I mean, that was perhaps the most important thing, is that it's... things are transformed and are ludic again. They're fun again. It's play. There was one time when we went to film the kidnapping scene, and the kids had guns, and they started to play at guns. And we thought, oh no, our film is becoming a repetition of their lives. It's sort of American liberal fear of playing with guns.
Right.
But what we realized is that they were playing with guns. What had happened is that they were kids who played with guns. They got into an armed group, and the play was all gone.
Yeah.
And so by putting the frame of play again, this is about play. It's not about seriousness.
The way a six-year-old might play with a stick and say this is a gun?
Or that it's a sword, or that it is anything else. The gun is transformed. By putting it in the frame of the movie screen, then it's a toy again.
Very interesting. And so, okay, so then you did these theater games, and then at a certain point, the writing process began.
Which is more a telling process than it is anything else. They began to think about, well, what are... We talked about the idea of desengaño, the idea of in the Spanish Baroque of disenchantment. And so where are places where people have disenchantment? We're in a city. Where are people disenchanted? We were filming in a very poor neighborhood, and so they began to think about where that might happen, whether that's in the lives of gang members, whether that's in the lives of street kids, whether that's in the case of two friends who might join competing gangs and would end up on opposite sides. And that's where the stories came out of.
We're talking to Kurt Shaw about the movie Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which is screening this coming Saturday at 1 o'clock at the CCA here in Santa Fe. So you were there the whole time, and then, okay, you go through the editing, you played a large role in the editing, then the film is done. What happens next? What happens to the young people who made it? What happens to the film?
One of the things we're most proud of is that of the 15 kids who made the film, none of them have gone back to join an illegal armed group. Even the Colombian government statistics show that more than half of the kids who try to leave the armed groups end up returning.
It's like recidivism rate to prison is what it sounds like.
Exactly. It's what they know. If you left school at 10 years old and you were carrying a gun for 6 years, those were your formative years. That's what you learned how to do.
Yeah.
And so you get out of that, and there are lots of people who want those skills, whether that's a drug trafficker, or whether that's another armed group, whether that's... I mean, in the best of cases, I suppose it's private security companies. But the challenge is, well, how do you get other skills? How do you get kids committed and passionate about other things? And what was really good about this film, I think, is that it made them passionate about something else. First of all, it made them passionate about making films. And some of them are actually now working in film and Colombian television. But more so...
Which is amazing.
It is. Yeah, it's stunning. It's Colombia. We're not talking Hollywood.
Yeah,
but... Nonetheless, it's...
They have a television industry.
Right. And it's pretty amazing to think that somebody who, 2 or 3 weeks before they started to work with us, had a gun in their hands, had a camera as a sort of transitional object, and then is working in Colombian television. I mean, it's pretty cool. But I think even more important, it made them passionate about their friends. There were kids from both sides. It's a really ideological war in Colombia between the right wing and the left wing. And we had kids who'd been in the paramilitaries and kids who'd been in the Marxist guerrillas. And yet they became really good friends. There's a sort of piece of folk wisdom among kids in the armed groups, that there are no friends in the armed groups. You can't trust anybody. Somebody's always going to narc on you. Somebody is going to tell the boss. You just can't trust anyone. And also, they might die. I mean, you can't make really good friendships there. And I think for the first time in their adolescent lives, since they'd been little kids, suddenly they had friends again. And it's interesting that when I talk to one or two of them, all of them know where everybody else is. Oh, yeah, Mario, he's gone back to to his family, and things are going really well back there in Yopal. Oh, and Jorge, he's there. And so it's great to know that they became passionate about their friends.
Now, does having made this film give them any kind of immunity from being sought out by the groups that they left?
I don't know if making the film does. I think that what it does more is that it gives them the strength to say that that's not what they want anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, they could be, in theory, sought out and murdered for having left.
They could very much so. And a lot of kids were worried about showing it in Colombia because they didn't want their old comrades to see it. And in fact, we've been very careful that it's only shown in Colombia, places where we know who the audience is going to be. In the rest of the world, we're not quite as worried. But
right.
In Colombia, we were very careful about that.
So you're showing it here this coming Saturday, and they will be there, these filmmakers, live via Skype.
Not everybody, but there are going to be at least a couple of them, probably four or five, who participated in it. And it's great to see the way that those things have changed over 3 years ago that we made the film. The two protagonists, the boy and the girl who fall in love in the film, fell in love in real life.
Really?
They'll be there on Skype with their daughter.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
It is. It's cute, but it also shows something about hope. And the last time I was in Colombia, I talked to them.
And about method acting.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. they commented that they're really excited to have made this film because, to a certain degree, it's going to help the world be a place where their daughter won't make the same mistakes they did.
Kurt Shaw is the executive director of the organization Shine a Light, which we didn't even talk about, but we'll get to that maybe another time. We'll have you back. And he's the director of the film Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which once again is screening this Saturday, October 30th at 1 o'clock at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Art here in Santa Fe. They're at ccasantafe.org, 982-1338. Kurt Shaw, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a second. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to introduce Jennifer Monson. She is a choreographer, and she's the artistic director of ILAND. That stands for Interdisciplinary Laboratory for Art, Nature, and Dance. She will be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. That's at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I have not yet experienced the work that you do. So lead us a little bit in talking about how you integrate dance and choreography with an attempt to understand the earth and the environment where people are.
I think the best place to start is with the first project that I did that brought me out into this type of environmental work. I've been living in New York City for over 10 years, and I was hanging out at an abandoned industrial site on the Brooklyn waterfront. And there was a broken hydrant, fire hydrant, and an abandoned field that had become a kind of urban wetlands area where migratory birds were stopping through. And I started to think about how migrations tie these global communities together, and also thinking about how animals navigate and their strategies for navigating. And that clicked with me as a way that I was also thinking about my own dancing experience. As a dancer, I move with my proprioceptive senses, especially as an improviser, moving through space with other dancers. And as I began to research animal navigation, that gave me the idea to do this project where I would actually get myself out of the city and literally follow the migrations of animals. So I followed gray whales from Baja California, Mexico, up the Pacific coast to Vancouver Island in Canada, ospreys from their nesting grounds in Maine, down the Atlantic Flyway through Cuba and Venezuela, and then ducks and geese up the Mississippi Flyway.
How did you do that? How did you follow them?
Well, we actually followed in cars. I wish we'd flown or taken boats or something.
Or hot air balloon.
Yeah. But all our performances were outdoors. And I actually did it as an attempt to get in closer contact with the cycles of the seasons, to learn more about celestial navigation, to pay attention to the tidal cycles. I think I had a relatively romantic notion at that point of getting back to nature. And the whole project just led me through a series of redefinitions of what nature means, what sustainability means, what conservation means, what sharing the planet with other animals means. And for some reason, for me, it makes complete sense to figure that out through the body. Like my body moving and dancing through a landscape produces a kind of knowledge of that place that's really particular to an embodied and embedded knowledge of place that's different than painting or photography because it is so experiential.
So you would dance in the landscape?
Yeah, so we would dance along the beaches, the first, or in parking lots or schoolyards or through marshes. We were often dancing in national parks or state parks or county parks or in schoolyards.
How many people, how many dancers were there doing this together?
I took three additional dancers besides myself, and there was a videographer documenting the project and then sometimes a project manager.
And so how is your dancing different? Like, describe the experience of dancing on a beach versus a parking lot versus a marsh.
The dancing along a beach is really particular because of the sand and the ocean and the wind. It becomes almost, there's a sense of borderlessness between the body and the environment, where I would say dancing in a parking lot or through streets, you're negotiating the built environment in a completely different way. And it's one that we're more familiar maybe with moving through. We're used to walking down sidewalks and crossing streets. But once you start dancing, you're moving through the streets, alongside of cars, changing your level, rolling. It's a quite intimate experience of a space that, you know, is considered dangerous or dirty. So that really shifts my perception of place and of dancing.
And if we were to, say, watch the dancers and take out the background, would we know where you were by the way you were moving?
That's a really excellent question. I've just been looking at the videos now, thinking about what I'm going to show tonight, and going back to look at this project of the gray whale migration, which was in 2000, which was quite a while ago, and I'm even trying to contextualize my work from a piece from 1993, and I'm actually seeing a lot of similarities in the movement, but there is a very different sense of space and timing in the work outdoors. I think often things slow down because there's so much information coming in and the energy spreads out into the space, whereas you're working in a more enclosed space, the energy kind of reverberates and resonates.
As they say, bouncing off the walls.
Exactly, yeah.
So you said a moment ago that you redefined your sense of nature from a romanticized concept of getting back to nature to something else. Tell us about that process.
So I actually, one reason I'm extremely happy to be here in Santa Fe is I grew up spending a lot of time in the high desert in Southern California. So I think my early experiences of dancing were navigating and climbing around, scrambling through these flesh-colored rocks. The place where I spent time was very near Joshua Tree National Monument. So I think I had a very special sense of being alone in a pretty pristine and untouched wilderness place. And I think living in New York, I began to feel sort of bereft and somewhat hopeless about the condition of the world, how quickly it was changing, that my children would never experience something that I'd experienced. And I think I had a kind of like a holding a place in time of what that was wilderness. But of course, what wilderness is constantly changing, especially in our sort of American psyche. So actually, you know, this urban wetlands with the broken fire hydrant, I began to see that, oh, this was just as much nature and just important on this navigational flyway as any other part. And then my next project after this bird brain migration was in an abandoned reservoir on the border of Brooklyn and Queens. So here's a built landscape, it was built in 1860, that's been abandoned and drained, and there's pretty much what one would consider a completely native habitat that's taken hold in this empty reservoir that's like the swamp forest you'd find out further on Long Island, but it's, you know, replaced itself in this, you know, this place it wouldn't be. It's on the top of the terminal moraine of the Wisconsin Ice Sheet. It's quite high, but there's still this swamp in it. So those kind of, the kind of resilience and fragility of those systems really inspire me. And I think dance is particularly useful for, well, just because I am a dancer, but looking at relationships of scale and temporal and spatial relationships as well. something like this reservoir, researching it from kind of geologic perspective, and then the kind of immediate presence of the space in relation to the, all the urban citizens that take advantage of it.
We're talking to choreographer Jennifer Monson. So how does the work you do translate into the community? In other words, the non-dancers, the audiences who might encounter your work?
So I'll use the example of this Ridgewood Reservoir project again. As part of my research, I invited the Brooklyn Bird Club to come in and do a nesting bird count, and local botanists and fish biologists. So there was a kind of that kind of scientific research. I introduced people to the reservoir that hadn't been familiar with it before. And then during the time that we were doing the project, the city decided to develop this reservoir site as a regional park and fill it and make ball fields. But the Brooklyn Bird Club was so excited that they'd found 60 acres of urban wilderness that was a really essential migratory route for migrating birds. And so they started a community group that has been successful in putting a moratorium on the development of the site. So there's kind of immediate activist outflow of that project. We also included 8 young Chinese dancers from a dance school in Elmhurst, Queens, and they presented work that we choreographed together in our June performances. And then people from the neighborhood could come and walk around the perimeter of the reservoir, and we had sort of docents that could talk about the dance, could talk about native plants, could talk about the birds, could talk about the architectural history of the reservoir. And I collaborated with some architects who set up these nice areas for the audience to sit and get more information and talk to people. So there are many ways to bring the audience into this experimental dance form that might seem sort of odd at first, but there were people who could encourage them and ask them questions about their experience with the project as well.
One of my favorite books of all time is Isadora Duncan's autobiography. And at the very beginning, she was so poor that she never had babysitters or anything like that. And she said that she learned to dance from the Pacific Ocean and the sky and the trees. And I love that idea that the rest of nature is teaching us how to move. Do you have that kind of experience of learning from nature itself?
Absolutely. In my studies, I've touched into a form called body-mind centering by Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, and she talks about the development of the embryo. And so she talks about that's the movement of the cell that creates development. So from the very beginning, it's movement that allows us to grow. And I think that my own experience of moving as a dancer in the studio and experiencing that evolution of an internal awareness with the external environment has been really important. And that we just finished a project on the New York City watershed. And every day we spent 15 minutes or so just witnessing the water. And I feel like over time, that experience of just witnessing the water on the New York City Harbor, which every day was completely different, had a quite profound physical experience inside of me and in the way that I'm dancing now.
It sounds like it's so related in a certain way to meditation, where you focus on the breath or you focus on some object of contemplation that has a steadiness to it but is also always changing.
Yes, I think that's really true. And there's something I'm looking at now between how you engage in watching someone else dance and how you engage in the intimacy of experience a landscape. And I think there's some interconnectedness between the empathy and emotional connections we make with each other and with landscape and the stories that landscapes tell and the stories that bodies hold. And my last project, this one on New York City watershed, as a very intimate one-on-one relationship with the performer and the audience, where we tried to develop a kind of system where you were both watching your partner and watching the whole group and the landscape at the same time. So that's I think, quite appropriate that you picked up on that, this kind of contemplative moment of perception and perceiving empathy with other and with place.
And, yeah, and you start to see the relationship between water, self, dance, landscape, other,
yeah,
in and a way that you wouldn't normally.
Yeah, and I've also been so interested in these different productions of knowledge or ways of knowing the world, because I myself am so drawn to scientific understandings, with the bird brain migration, hanging out with folks who were doing satellite tracking of the ospreys and of gray whales and learning about native plants and the water cycle and stream restoration projects, and I feel like I'm trying to lay out a kind of a sharing of that kind of knowledge, which is why I set up ILANG to support that kind of interdisciplinary creative process.
Jennifer Monson is a choreographer and artistic director of iLand, which can be found on the web at ilandart.org. And once again, she'll be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. That's at 6 o'clock. You can go to sfai.org or call 505-424-5050. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.